Every day I'm moving further from sobriety. Every day I'm moving further from sobriety. Every day I'm moving further from sobriety. Further from sobriety. So sobriety. Every day I'm moving further from sobriety.
And now it's time for Homegrown, your only show dedicated to local art with your host. Well, just me, Clinton. Hey! Good morning, Sunday morning! Whether you're an art breaker, an art maker, an art faker, or an art partaker, welcome all, because of course all are welcome to Homegrown, your only show dedicated to local art. I'm the one they call Clinton. I've been abandoned today by David and Leslie, who both had better things to do and told me to go take a flying leap, which I am so used to hearing from David and Leslie. So you're just stuck with me. Fortunately, you're also stuck with me and our great, great guests, which we will turn to. Welcome. Get ready for some art. Yeah. Okay. So here we're just going to jump into our first guest, Greg Maglione. How are you today, sir?
I'm good, thanks. How are you, sir?
I am welcome. I'm welcome.
You're welcome.
Good. Thank you very much. It's going to be a rocky start. So, Greg, you are the founder, director, and the board president of the Accessibility Music Project.
There you go. Yep.
Could you tell us what the Accessibility Music Project is?
So, what we do is actually Accessible Music Project.
Oh, sorry.
And that's okay. And it's a lot to handle. Well, you got my name really right, so that is totally awesome. You obviously did your homework there. So in a nutshell, we're just about making music more accessible to what we refer to as the access-limited demographic, which you can pretty much just imagine is anyone whose access to traditional local venues is limited. They live in nursing homes. They live in senior communities, assisted living. We have a lot of developmentally and physically disabled neighbors whose access is limited. And our job is to, our vision is to bring the local music scene to these folks who can't necessarily get to it. That simple.
Sounds good. Sounds good. So from the little reading I did, my understanding is that you and the people who started, you guys were musicians yourselves, right?
Correct. Yep.
So how did you, first off, how long has this been going on? And two, how did you, what was it inspired you to start this?
So, 1995 actually is when I began doing this. I was, working in an office here in town. And one of my coworkers, knew she had come down and listened to me play at a couple of, you know, local small venues. And one day she says to me, you know, if my mom and my aunt could come down and listen to your music, they would love it. But they can't come. They live in a nursing home. Why don't you go play for them? So with a little bit of hemming and hawing and, you know, the traditional sort of, you know, gee, I can't do that, I said, okay, I'll do it. I conceded. And within a couple of months, I started to go up there on Wednesday afternoons and play for about an hour just in their room. The room got packed with residents, and they came to me, the activities director, and said, why don't you do a monthly concert? So I started doing that and kept going for a couple of years, and I started up the Songs for Seniors program. And this is sort of an interesting twist. So I'm playing out at a nursing home, I think it was, out on Pantops. Mm-hmm. And there was a businessman who used to come in. He would deliver supplies to this place, and he would always stop and listen to a song and give me a thumbs up. And so one day he stops, and then I'm finishing up, and he says, man, you know, what are you doing? He's like, this is crazy. Like, you're playing REM, and you're playing the Beatles, and you're playing all that stuff that, you know, you wouldn't expect these folks to, you know, people to come in here and play. And right. I said, well, you know, they love it, obviously. And he said, yeah. And I said, well, and I do this at about a dozen facilities here in town. And the light bulb goes on for this guy. He's like, really? He's like, if you could get my name in front of those other businesses, I would sponsor you. Well, I was racing motorcycles at the time. I knew about the power of sponsorship, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so I took him up on that and figured out a way to, you know, I started making up T-shirts and flyers and, you know, programs and that kind of thing and selling ad space. And so kind of, you know, that's how I got started. That was 98 that I started that Songs for Seniors program and started up the sponsorship. And you know, I'm pretty crazy. Over the years, we've had support from folks like REM, Dolly Parton, Billy Joel, You know, we've had musicians like David Wilcox, right. You know, those sorts of folks come and play for us.
Yeah, so you've got, four concert series going on
right
now?
We have four going right now.
And yep. Who are the musicians that you get for this? Are they local musicians? Are they visiting musicians?
Well, both. Right now, so 2016, we started up the Accessible Music Project formally, and so it was mm-hmm. myself, Mike D'Antoni, DeLoy Moore, and Joe Tucker were the four musicians who got together and said, let's give it a go. You know, I had a lot of experience with it. I said, you guys just help me provide the music. So those guys, we've had Greg Howard come and play,
great
local musician,
great.
A local duo called One Hand Clapping, Dan Haig and his partner David, Mike D'Antoni, like I mentioned, Susan Munson, John
Love
Spear
Susan.
Is coming to play. Let's see when John's coming. March 1st, he and Dara James are coming there, Old Soul, the blues duo. Got Rob and Leslie Williams coming. Rob's from Richmond. Diane Cluck and West Swing. John Rimel.
Great people.
Yeah, and then, you know, eventually we do want to bring visiting musicians in as well, people who are touring through the area. And one thing I want to stress that I forgot to say when you asked what do we do,
mm-hmm.
We're the only organization that I know of in the country that sees this demographic, the access limited demographic, as a professional opportunity, not a volunteer possibility. Everybody knows music heals. And yet for some reason, musicians seem to believe that, well, we should do this out of the kindness of our hearts and we shouldn't get paid. And I'm like, you know, I don't see the doctors volunteering. I don't see the drug companies giving their medications for free. So I don't really understand why we believe that. So we pay musicians, and actually we probably pay one of the best going rates on an hourly basis that anybody in this town makes.
You know, on the Facebook page of a local musician, I forget which one, but just this week he put up one of those graphics, and somebody had written on the graphic that the going rate for a good bar band in 1975 or something like that was $100 per musician.
Right.
And then the graphic went on to say that a good bar band can today get $100 per musician still.
For a 4-hour gig. Plus load in and load out, plus
right.
travel.
That $100 in 75
yeah.
translates to somewhere around $600 worth of spendable
right.
money. And so, like that, and it was moving to show how little.
Yeah, and so it's interesting to me that as much as we try to appeal to the young local musicians here, we can't get them to come play. But I'll pay a solo act $100 for a 1-hour show, and you don't need to pack a bunch of equipment. You don't need to travel. You just pretty much show up with your guitar and a small amplifier and, you know, rock and have a really good time in front of an attentive, appreciative audience that came to listen to you. They didn't come to drink. They didn't come to socialize. They didn't come to watch the basketball game. They came
to
listen to you.
Yeah, so how are those venues? Well, first, so I have a couple of questions. One, and you've kind of talked about this already, but what type of music are they playing? Because as soon as you talk about the accessibly challenged, what's the
access limited?
The access limited demographic,
right?
And you're talking about playing in assisted living homes and in nursing homes.
There's a stereotype.
Yeah, there's a stereotype.
There's a stereotype.
Right?
You know, they all want to hear
exactly
the old stuff,
saying,
and they all
right?
want to hear gospel, right? That is like so, you know.
Although as time goes on, what those people are going to consider old stuff is going to get more and more.
It's going to get more and more. Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah. And like I
like
used
no
to say,
no one's saying
that,
like, play me some Benny Goodman. Like
right,
that's not happening. Right.
Right. right. No. You know, the most requests you get that are I would call traditional or to be expected are gospel kind mm-hmm. of requests. But you know, I get that. But one of my theories has long been that even if these folks weren't listening to the Beatles, they were down in the kitchen fixing dinner or washing the dishes, and the kids were upstairs with the Beatles cranked up. So they were listening to the Beatles, even though they didn't. So when I play a Beatles song, they get it. They uh-huh. they remember it. But, you know, the whole idea is to introduce them to singer-songwriter, the local singer-songwriter stuff. And even, I think, respectfully presented, you know, I'll go so far as to say hip hop. You know, you gotta watch your language. You gotta watch your subject matter. You gotta relate to your audience. But if you present it respectfully and tastefully and you tone it down, I mean, you can't come in with your whole PA system and crank it up to 90,000 decibels. If you come in respectful and tasteful and you talk a little bit about the music and you engage the audience,
right.
It works.
Well, it's just about knowing your audience,
it's
right?
about knowing your audience, which is exactly what everything is if you're going to right. be successful.
That's interesting. I can imagine that that can be a potentially powerful thing for not just the artist, but also for that audience to have people come in and not assume that their musical taste and their musical interest died 50 years ago.
Right. Don't judge a book by its cover. You know, everybody wants to go on an adventure. I don't care how old you are, and your adventure might be limited. You know, you can't go to King's Dominion and ride the big roller coaster anymore. Okay, fine. But it doesn't mean you can't be taken on a musical adventure, a very modern, a very contemporary musical adventure. Everybody wants to hear, and we want to hear from the young people. We want to hear what's going on out there in the world. And so present it to us with your music. Present it to us with your stories. Present it to us with your artistry and your... You know, dance if it involves that or whatever. You know, people.
You know, this fascinates me because long time listeners. If we have like one or two long time listeners of the show, but long time listeners of the show will have heard me talk about this. Like, I used to go to live music a whole bunch when I was younger,
right?
And like as I got older, and as I started aging out of the group of people who were still going to live music. Once I was, you know, I'm walking into clubs, I'm walking into bars, I'm like, I'm the oldest person here.
Exactly.
And I no longer want to stand around
right.
on a beer-soaked floor for
right.
the next 2 or 3 hours.
Right.
You know, I'd like to be able to, and, you know, and I'm getting to the place where it kind of bugs me that I can't understand any of the words that the lead singer is saying and the sound
right.
and then the sounds and the sound guy has pumped everything up
yeah.
and it's all one big mush and it's just I'm no longer having fun.
The drugs are wearing off.
The drugs are wearing off, exactly. So unfortunately there are a lot of musicians. I mean, I still love music, but I don't get to see a lot of people live.
Right.
And it's made me think about how limiting your options are to see music live if you're not going to see it, you know, in a bar, in a club.
Right. Right. Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, and also think about, the rock bands that, you know, and then like, Foo Fighters and Dave Grohl. So Foo Fighters has this great song, you know, it's Times Like These, and it's this
right.
rocking song. Well, go to YouTube and find Dave Grohl doing that in an unplugged format, just Dave on the guitar. It's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
So again, you know, if you're a musician and you're in this, you know, hard rock band, well, all of you play acoustic stuff. And so when one or two members pull out and come to the community venues, as we call them, and present the same music, but just in that kind of format, it's every bit as genuine, and I would argue it's even more genuine, you know, for both the listener and the musician, because it really comes down to being now about the music, about the experience of music and what that does between the artist and the listener.
Yeah. So talking about the experience of music, I can imagine that that some musicians who are used to the bar setup might balk at how at one, their expectations of what this type of gig is, and two, at stereotypes, at the idea of something new. What are these gigs like?
Dude, it's one of the most, the only word I can come up with is intimidating. It's very intimidating. We brought in, I won't name him, but we brought in someone from a local rock band that travels all around the East Coast and does lots of college gigs and all that. And he came in to do a 1-hour show over at the Cedars. Didn't bring a set list, which is, you know, fine. I get that, right?
Right,
this
right.
is a guy who's totally capable of pulling off, you know, 50 minutes of music. He stood in front of probably 25, you know, 28 people who were there, and every one of them was staring at him. Every one of them was so tuned into him. By the fourth song, he completely forgot the next what he could possibly play next. He was stepping in a fetching. So,
wow.
You know, he pulled it off. Unfortunately, a friend of his was there and was able to prompt him a little bit, and, you know, and it was a great show, and the people loved it. But I'm telling you, man, this is not the bar thing. This is what so many artists complain that You know, nobody listens to me. Nobody appreciates me. Nobody, right. You know, everyone's like, Freebird, play Freebird, you know, and very rarely does someone come up and say, man, that song that you wrote, you know, it really spoke to me because I lost my dad or my girlfriend left me or that rarely happens in your bar gigs. Right. You're lucky if you kind of get recognized. But it happens in these gigs, you know, people are tuned in. They came to listen to you and that's what they're doing. And so they will talk to you about songs. It's they're very engageable and they're very engaging. And that can be intimidating for a lot of musicians. I believe that the stereotypes sometimes help us when we're younger, to put distance between us and that kind of experience. We sort of maybe have to ease into that kind of experience. I know that I did, mm-hmm. You know, when I started doing this, I was, you know, 35 years old. So I wasn't, you know, a 20-year-old who was, you know, up and coming and rocking in front of the bar bands and all that. It probably would have been intimidating for me, as well.
Right. All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break and then come back
all right.
to it. This is Homegrown. And here's a drop.
This is Eli Cook, and you're listening to Homegrown on 94.7.
18 minutes past the hour, 19 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to Homegrown here on 94.7 WPVC, your only show dedicated to local art. If you're just joining us, I'm here with Greg Morgoglione, the founder, director, and president of the board for the Accessible Music Project, and we're talking about said project. So, when I was reading about the project, it seemed like there were two parts of it, and you've talked to one, which was the benefits of it or the strength of it from the artist's point of view.
Right.
Where this is, as you say, this is a market for artists and a chance for musical artists to do some paid gigs for a whole set of audience that they didn't know. But you also talk about it from the audience's point of view, and the word that I keep reading is therapeutic.
Absolutely.
Can you talk about that aspect?
Well,
of it?
Absolutely. And it's funny and you know, not to minimize what you just said, but like, that's so obvious. Everybody knows you can go anywhere, and ask someone, you know, do you think music is therapeutic? Do you think music heals? Well, of course it does. Everybody knows. And yet again, why do we feel like we as healers should not be compensated professionally to mm-hmm. go and perform in these. So it is therapeutic and not just the music. But I think the fact that I have long said that you could drive up to, you know, a nursing home and take an empty guitar case, walk in the front door, walk through the dining hall at lunch when the place is packed, wave to people, say, hi, how you doing? Give them a wink, give them a smile, walk right through the dining room. The people in that room would think, oh, wow, somebody is here to play guitar for their grandmother or their mom or their dad or whatever. I'm telling you, if you put vital sign monitors, blood pressure monitors and all that kind of thing on these people in that dining hall, there would be positive improvement just from you walking through with an empty guitar case.
Mm-hmm.
I'm telling you, and if there's some medical people out there who would like to do an experiment with me, I'd love to have you come and help us out because you know, I'd love to document that sort of thing. So think of what it does.
I believe that. I took guitar lessons for the longest time, and I would notice that, like, early in the morning, I would be getting out of my car, and people are passing me, going to work in front of my guitar teacher's home.
Yep.
And as soon as I pulled out my guitar case, I could notice that people passing by noticing that would smile.
Yeah, bingo.
And some of them would, even give me a wave.
Yep. Like, bingo, yep. Absolutely. And so it's, you know, not just the musical thing, but it's the fact that, you know, these folks, think about it. There are, I don't even know, 30, maybe more, communities that we, not that we serve all of them, but like the communities that we serve in this area, and musicians and everybody from every walk of life drives past these places all the time, walks past them on the downtown mall, never stops in to say hello, never stops in to acknowledge them. So suddenly now you're included in the community.
Well, that's part of the tragedy of those places, because they seem to be so Isolated,
absolutely. And we don't recognize that, look, these are the people that built the venues that we play in. They paved the streets here. They taught the kids. They fed the workers at the restaurants. And, these are the people that created this world that we're living in right now. And so it's kind of interesting, to say the least, that we have no recognition of or respect for them, that we can't even just walk in for 10 minutes or 20 minutes or an hour and play music for them and say thank you without saying thank you, you know?
Yeah.
So it's therapeutic from all sorts of points of view. And I have to also tell you, I've sold more CDs than you would imagine in these venues. So if you do come prepared and talk it up. Say, this is a song I just put it out on my CD last year, and it's about, my time with, in Indonesia and la-di-da. And somebody at the end of that there's a good chance they're going to say, why did you say you have a CD? How much is it? And they're going to whip out the cash and buy it from you. So
I so now want to be a fly on the wall for the experience where some kid is dragged to see grandma or grandpa in the home, and they say, oh yeah, have you heard of such and such and such and such? I've got his new CD here. I was listening to
exactly. Yeah. And I encourage, that's a good, I appreciate that, because, I've talked to other artists of other genre, like clay and stone workers and painters and that kind of thing. And I say, why wouldn't you go set up an art showing in places like this? And again, there are some sort of stereotypical objections of, well, they don't really have money, disposable income to spend on this sort of thing. They're not really in the acquiring phase of their life. Mm. And my sort of response to that is, well, here's the thing. If someone buys your little clay pitcher or, whatever it is, or your little piece of art to hang on their wall, they not only got this little piece of art, but when someone comes to visit, they're going to go, oh, that's a beautiful painting. Where did you get that? They just got a story to tell.
Right.
They just got a memory to relive. They got this humongous boost to who they are. And so I think, again, it's very selfish of us to stereotype and to rule, these kinds of experiences for folks, rule them out just based on our preconceived notions.
Yeah.
About what art should be and where it should be done. And, First Fridays, I think, should be in some of the lobbies of some of these places and should invite the public to come, and the artist should sit there and talk. And, Tom Festival and those kinds of things should set up venues there. If you can do the front porches down in Belmont, you can do the front porches at, these community venues.
That's great. I mean, this is a show about art, and I hope that we've looked at art from different viewpoints, but I don't think we've talked before about access to art.
Yeah.
And talked about just that for, I think the t-shirt phrase for the show is preconceptions of where art should be and where it should be done. That's
right.
Just,
yeah. No, yeah. It's really stunning. And I'm actually working on an essay now about, the concept of ageism among artists. And it's
right,
most people react very, very strongly when you attach any ism to artists, especially to our socially conscious musicians. But the facts speak for themselves. You just go sit in the lobby of any of these community venues that we serve and count how many musicians come in and play that week.
Yeah.
And you won't use up more than probably, the fingers on one hand. So what's happening here? I don't know. It's an enormous opportunity. And it should not be a volunteer, sense of duty kind of thing.
Right, right.
We're professionals, and we should respect ourselves as such. And you don't have to be a starving artist unless you want to. I hate to tell you all that, but choice is everything,
So have you gotten feedback from the administrators of these facilities?
Absolutely.
in terms of the effect on
absolutely.
The audience, what's the feedback?
So it's all positive. It's all positive. And I'll tell you, so the best story that I have, I believe it was 2003, I started to go to the Kluge Children's Rehab Center, right, which is no longer in existence. But So I used to go out there and sit in the lobby and just sort of play in the corner. So if people wanted to come listen, they could. And if they didn't want to listen, they could go to the other end of the room. And the very first time I played, about 2 weeks later, I get a letter from Kelly Bell, who was the director of whatever. And she says to me, she says, you know, I got feedback from some of the doctors that day who did not know you were in the lobby playing music, that they noticed a difference in some of their, some of the children that came to see them that day, and they couldn't figure out what it was until the word got to them that someone had been in the lobby playing music.
Oh.
I still have that letter. I mean, you know,
wow,
bam. Yeah. Right. This is, you know, this is, this is why we do what we do. Whether it's in a bar or whatever, you know, we're not entertainers. We're therapists for the soul, man. We're spiritual chiropractors, to steal a couple of lines from Dr. Carl Polnack, who gave a great presentation many years ago on that subject. And, you know, so the fulfill, this is where you really, really find the fulfillment. I mean, you find it in the bars, too.
Right.
I'm not trying to take away that, but it's really in your face in these sorts of venues.
Cool.
Yeah.
Greg, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thank you, Clinton. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, my pleasure. All right. We're going to go to our list of things coming up this week. Let's have a little backing music here. Oh, there we go. All right, currently running until April 13th, the American Shakespeare Center presents its 2019 Actors Renaissance season, featuring Henry IV, Part 1, and The Merry Wives of Windsor by William Shakespeare. And starting on February 7th, actually going on now, right? Yeah. Anne Page, Hates Fun. And starting March 8th, coming up, Arden of Faversham, all at Blackfriars in Stanton. Currently running. You've got the last chance to check out these exhibits, Second Street Gallery. They're pairing two painters with two photographers, Sharon Shapiro and Stacey Evans from the McGuffey Art Center, and Russ Warren and Bill Moritz. McGuffey Art Center, of course, observing Black History Month, celebrating Charlottesville Black creative community, looking for work by Daryl Rose, Rose Hill, Michael E. Williams, Anthony Scott, Dina Jennings, Bolanle Adeboye, Liz Sherry Jones, Sahara Clemens, and more. Check out this exhibit if you haven't. Then you need to, and if you have been listening to Homegrown for all this month, we've been interviewing those artists. Go back and check us out at SevoPodcast.com, or check out the live feeds on Facebook. Some great stuff. New City Arts, an exhibit of paintings, embroideries, and sculptures inspired by Latina women, by Karina A. Monroy. Chroma Arts Project presents Laura Wooten's Spirit of Place, Landscapes Real and Imagined, and Jennifer Escher's When Time Abstracts Truth. The Vibrant Stitch Art Collective displaying their artistic quilts at New Dominion Workshop. We got a past episode on that as well. And get there while you can, Piedmont Virginia Community College, with two exhibits in the North and South Galleries, each with the V in the V Earl Dickinson Building. The North Gallery features Skyward by photographer John Grant, and the South Gallery features Lookout, a collection of community portraits by Eze Amos, Aaron Farrington, Jay Johnson, Greg Antrim Kelly, Jesus Pino, Sanjay Suchak, and Guillermo Ubia. Currently running from now until March 3rd, Guerrilla Theater Productions does Ibsen's Hedda Gabler. I hear that this production has a Southern twist to it. On February 26th, the UVA Fralin Art Museum offers Toddlers in Artland, where museum educator Emily Lazaro introduces parent and toddler pairs to big ideas in development theory through playful practice strategies. February 28th to March 2nd, Tandem Friends School's Upper School Drama Program presents 26 Pebbles, a drama about people recovering after trauma. February 28th to March 7th, the UVA Drama Department presents the drama about a family clashing over issues of race and privilege, Stickfly, in the Ruth Kaplan Theater. On the 28th, also, the Darden School of Business presents 27 women artists from Charlottesville and the surrounding areas in celebrating creativity, works by local women artists. Also on the 28th, Second Street Gallery offers a studio visit and artist talk with Stacey Evans and Guillermo X. Ubila from 4:30 to 6:30 p.m. That sounds fascinating. On the 28th, also, lots of stuff coming on the 28th. Of course, the UVA MFA reading series continues with grad students Emily Nason and Juani Suarez reading from their work at the New Dominion Bookshop. Dreama Bell presents another rapturous drag show with the ladies of Rapture at the Rapture Restaurant Bar on the 28th. March 1st, of course, is First Fridays, and that features openings of art exhibits at gallery spaces in and around downtown. We're talking Lee Christmas Halstead showing her waterscapes at the Charlottesville Writer House, Susan Patrick showing her watercolors and multimedia drawings in her show Debris at New Dominion Bookshop, photographer-turned-painter Cassandra Clausen presenting her exhibit Flow at VMDO Architects, and Pete Morris's acrylic painting show Northern Neck Nature at Top Knot Studios, and more. Check them out. March 1st, young writers read their poetry, short stories, and perform their music at New Dominion Workshop. Dominion Bookshop's Friday Night Writes Reading Series. And, of course, the improv group Big Blue Door presents their first Friday improv at McGuffey Arts Center. And for your music options this week, today, Gina Sobel at Pippin Hill Farm Vineyards at 1 p.m. Kaylee Garrett and harmonica master Gary Green at Glasshouse Winery at 2 p.m. Biscayer, Lavelle, and Miller play the blues at Star Hill Brewery Tap Room at 3 p.m. Also today, the University of Virginia Chamber Music Series presents the Albemarle Ensemble playing Robert Musinski's Movements for a Wind Quartet, Opus 16, and Kenji Bunk's Changes of Phase at 3:30 at Old Cavill Hall. Tonight, King Golden Banshee at the Tin Whistle Irish Pub and Maddie Metcalf playing the keys at Fellini's. Tomorrow, the Twisted Branch Tea Bazaar presents The Moonbees, an evening of space folk rock with Studebaker Huck and Rhode Island's Los Durarinos. Tomorrow, jazz fusion quartet Onyx Manor plays Rapture on the 26th. Brand new band Llama Drama at Dirty Nelly's. Then Lewis Smith and Friends at Fellini's on the 27th. Ben and Gabe doing the bluegrass at the Whiskey Jar. Bobblehead throws down original 1960s style rock at Dirty Nelly's. And on the 27th and 28th, Josh Mayo hosts his open mic night at 1221 Market Street. On the 28th, Fry's Pink Beach Club presents a Cajun dance party featuring Central Virginia's Cajun masters, Bayou Faux Pas. Also on the 28th, the Weed Eaters at the Whiskey Jar, Neil Goodlow at Dirty Nelly's, Tonya Ray and the T-Ray Band at the Whiskey Jar. March 1st, celebrate Brazilian Carnival at Glasshouse Winery with Beliza and special guests Alejandro and Leonardo Lucchini, and throw down with Eli Cook at Dirty Nelly's. Our friends on March 1st, Mama Tried and Cherry Red celebrate Charlie Graw at the Ixar Park. We got Faster Than Walking at the Tin Whistle Irish Pub, and Red and the Romantics and Baby Joe's Mardi Gras celebration at the Whiskey Jar. On March 2nd, Black Voices Gospel Choir present their winter benefit concert, When the Praises Go Up, benefiting residents of Charlottesville Public Housing at UVA's University Chapel. And the Blue Ridge Irish Music School traditional ensemble at the Tin Whistle Irish Pub every Sunday. You got Travis Elliott at Rapture every Monday. It's the Bluegrass Jam at the Front Porch Roots Musical. Seafoot, Charlottesville Friends of Old Time Music, weekly open jam at the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Unitarian Church. Where else? Tango Music with Miles Peterson, Matty Metcalf at the Bebedero, Red and the Romantics at the Whiskey Jar, the Songwriter Night at the Local every Tuesday, Latin Guitar Night with Miles Pierce and Humberto Sales at the Bebedero, the Ragged Mountain String Band at the Whiskey Jar, traditional Irish session at the Tin Whistle Irish Pub on Wednesday, Bachata Fusion at the Ix Art Park, the Mike Rosensky and Jeff Decker Quartet at Miller's every Thursday. It's Humberto Sales and Vincent Zorn doing the Gypsy Rumba at the Bebedero, and of course, every Thursday, John Dearth with the John Dearth Quintet at Miller's, because every once in a while, you just got to come down to Dearth. And those are just some of the musical options and the artistic options in our wonderful artistic town. Let's do a drop.
This is David Tewksbury, singer-songwriter from Charlottesville, Virginia, and you are listening to Homegrown on 94.7 WPVC.
36 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Homegrown, of course. I'm Clinton. David and Leslie are out for the week, off doing licentious and probably illegal things. They should be back if the cops haven't gotten them next week. But first, we'll turn to our second guest and our continuing and final bit of coverage. Can we call it coverage? I don't know if we can call it coverage. Makes us sound like we're news. And certainly we are not news. We're not media news, but we're news to you. Our final coverage of Black History Month at McGuffey Art. We've got here, of course, Bob Anderson, and he's brought with him two fine people. Bob, how you doing?
Just great, Clinton. Thank you again for having us here.
It's been great having you guys here. It's been such a wonderful way to celebrate Black History Month. Thank you so much, guys, so much for doing this.
Well, you know, this is today is the very last day of Black History Month.
McGuffey Art Center. We open it at 1 p.m. and close at 5, so it's a short day. But anyone who has not been there, they had better get over there because the work is just spectacular. Everyone who's seen it, who's talked to me, has just ranted about how wonderful they thought the artwork was.
And, it's a great show. Yeah. It's a great show, and people should definitely take that. If you have plans today, change them. Until 5 o'clock, you've got to get to McGuffey and see this show.
And at 5 o'clock, we tear everything down. When you walk in the door, if you come in through the elevator or through the north end of the building, the very first artist work you see is Michael Williams. And I think because that's the first art you see, it's maybe appropriate. He's the last artist to come on the show here. So he's here with me today. And it's nice to have you with me.
Good morning. Thanks. Good to be here.
Michael E. Williams, thank you for coming. Welcome to Homegrown.
Homegrown.
How are you, sir?
I am doing well. And you?
Good, 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 good. So what has it been like having your stuff hang at McGuffey?
Well, it's a different experience. It's the second exhibit. I'd done a previous exhibit, but spent some time ago. But it's been overwhelming. It's been pleasurable.
Excellent, excellent, excellent. So talk about your art. It's their paintings, and it's oil paintings, right?
Oil on canvas, yes. A lot of the neighborhoods I do in the backgrounds, I'm doing figures a lot. I just got into doing figures a few years ago. And I try to capture a lot of the neighborhoods because it seemed to be disappearing. Mm. And in the community, that kind of thing. So
yeah, talk about that. Because looking at your work, I was looking at it's I think of I mean, one of the fun things about this exhibit is the range of work and the range of different subject matter. And your work seems to be the most of this time and of this period, the one that focuses on the most local stuff.
Yeah. Well, it's a community I grew up in. I'm a lifelong resident of Charlottesville. Grew up in, like I said, it kind of hanging on to some of those things that's disappearing, you know, the Great Avenue thing, the 10th and Page. I mean, 10th and Page at intersection has completely changed from when we grew up, gentrification, the kind of thing, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So just trying to hang on to that kind of thing and incorporating the figures in along with that. Also.
Cool, cool. That's really interesting because one of the things I noticed about your work is that you've got paintings of people working. And you don't see a lot of that. Like you've got paintings of like actual workers.
Oh yeah. Well, what comes to mind? The Gandhi dancers. These guys working on the railroad for one thing. Uh-huh. Now they have a African festival at the Washington Park, and these guys would come. They would show and they would do demonstrations of how they would actually put this railroad. And I was so fascinated with that, taking photos of. So that's what inspired that particular working aspect. So, you know, so
cool, cool. Can you talk about your relationship with color? Because one of the things I noticed about the work are the colors, not just the colors you use, but how you use color. It's so I don't really have the words to describe it. The best that I could say is fiery. Like it's not simple enough to say it's vibrant, but there's just so it's such a live dynamic use of color. Can you talk about
that? Well, that would come to my mind, vibrant, if you're saying it, and mostly perspective, trying to balance things, moving figures back and forth, that kind of thing, as you're using colors as well, you know, and it just happens, you know. I'm just getting in the zone, and they just come, you know. So I mean, it's kind of like you said, it's just hard to explain, but just looking for a resource, you're trying to get the energy, you know, that kind of thing. So,
and how do you? And this we've asked this question of artists who've been on the show before, like how do you know when you've gotten the edge? Because it's like, for instance, the difference between somebody who's because you've got somebody who's doing really representative art. Like they're doing art that's supposed to look real. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, you know, you're done when it looks like what it looks in real life. But when you've got stuff like yours, which is more impressionistic, like how do you know? Okay, that's it. I've gotten there.
Oh. Well, you don't. And you go back, and I can pick up things I worked on years ago, and wow, because it's still a learning process for me. So I'm still in the learning process. But I hang stuff up. You get back, you look at it, you see it, and there's some things that nag at you. And sometimes, you know, you can make them better, and sometimes you're better off leaving well enough alone, you know. Mm. So it's an ongoing struggle, you know, as most artists would tell you probably.
That's, yeah, wow.
Yeah.
What amazes me about Michael is his passion for the art.
Well, you can really, that passion, that's a really great word, because you could feel that coming through.
Yeah, absolutely.
In the paintings.
I mean, when I first met him, I went down into his basement, and that's where he paints. And I just couldn't believe it. The walls were packed with paintings. They were all over the place, sometimes two or three deep. And then you'd see pallets covered with paint all over the place. I mean, we took photographs of it. And just looking at his basement is like looking at a work of art. But looking at that, I could, and talking to Michael, I could tell, you know, this is something that this person has been born with, and he can't escape it. You know, it's part of him.
Yeah, and his first comment was, you like most artists, got a lot of junk. You're like, well, thank you very much. but I mean, it's been going. It's an ongoing thing. I hadn't gotten to the marketing part. I'm still in the painting phase of it. You know, and it's the learning process at the same time. You know,
That's cool. That's cool. Mm-hmm. May I just say that one of the things, at least for me personally, that spoke to me about your work and related to your use of color was what happened when you applied your color aesthetic to doing the skin of black people. Because so frequently, it feels like so frequently in the popular culture, and also when you go back to, and talking about, you know, Rose Hill's work, when you go back to more racist culture, black skin is presented so monolithically, so monochromatically, and you think about the again about blackface minstrelsy, but you look at the way you paint skin, and there are all of these different pigments, all just moving around there. And there's more. I think there's more red and yellow and ochre than you'll find brown or black. And it's just like, yeah.
Yeah. Well, because you know, if you think about it, you know, I mean, it's blood under your skin. Your skin is a thin layer there, you know, and you got the light reflecting from different things or whatever. I'm conscious of that, because you don't want to be all light skin or dark skin, that kind of thing. So I do kind of experiment and kind of play around with that, you know.
So. Cool.
As an artist, I like to move in on my subject and look at it in extreme detail. And when you do that, it could be a still life, it could be a person, it could be an animal, it could be a tree. But what you see from far away loses that monolithic look. As you get in closer, you just see that almost every color in the rainbow is on that little patch of area that you're looking at.
Right.
And you can, if you apply that to a painting of a person you're doing and understand that, it really comes through it, and it has a life that you're not going to get with the kind of thing that we were talking about earlier, some of Rose's jobs. But we'll get into that in a minute.
Indeed. Indeed. And I think that's actually a good place for us to take a break and play a couple of spots. All right, we're going to do a drop.
Yeah, you want to switch out?
This is Homegrown.
Hi, this is Priyanka Shetty, and you're listening to Homegrown, your show about local art, 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.
You rock.
Woo!
There you go. 47 minutes past the hour, you're listening to Homegrown, 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. I'm here talking with you, and we're here with Bob Anderson. We just talked to Michael E. Williams, and he's got somebody else to with you. We're going to be talking to Daniel O'Neill in just a moment. But first, so making that transition, or making a transition, we were just talking about how Mike works with colors in terms of black skin. I think that's a nice transition to talk a little bit about Rose. You want to talk a little bit about Rose Hill works, Rose Hills.
I want to fit Liz Cherry Jones in quickly.
Okay, do that.
But should we do that first?
Yeah, yeah, do that.
Make that happen.
Liz was a member of McGuffey for a long time. She was an educator in the area. She died at a very young age. To me, it was young. Before she should have died. That's what the way I look at it. But she was a really fine person in the community. She worked, taught in several of the schools around here. But she passed away a year ago, August, very unexpectedly, had a brain tumor. Liz was born in Philadelphia. She went to school there. She's college educated. She was a very, very intelligent woman, very individualist, I should say. And she taught at the Governor's School. My son actually had her as a teacher there. While she was teaching in the school system here, she would call me up once in a while because I had done some children's books, and she would invite me over, and I would present the books to the kids. But she was always very involved, and everybody who knew her loved her very much. There's a retrospective of her work at McGuffey right now on the second floor. And
it's a nice retrospective. It's a range of different works.
Yeah, it's very, very nice. And unfortunately, we couldn't get examples of everything because she had some jewelry work that she did that would have created a security problem we weren't able to handle. So we didn't show any of that. But I'll quickly read off her statement. This is something she wrote for one of the last shows that she had. She said, "My intent is to create fine artworks that are metaphorical reflections of the roles of women of color in American history. I use multimedia image layering and fiber arts construction techniques to summon forth generations and regenerations of cultural identity. Historical research is a constant and integral aspect of my work." That was the last thing she wrote on her last art statement for the last show she had. So. And that pretty much sums up the kind of work she did, and it gives you a little insight into her intelligence and how serious she was about her work.
It makes me think of the examples of the work that she did that she's got hanging, or that you guys have hanging of her corsets.
Exactly.
And my understanding of those have been a big hit for people who've come seeing. Yeah. Again, you've got till 5 p.m. Go see Mike's work and
really need to go see that.
These corsets. They're interesting.
Now let's get to Rose Hill.
Let's get to Rose Hill.
Rose Hill. Her work is
easily, I think, the most challenging of the work.
Oh, absolutely.
In the whole display.
She has taken images many of which were created back at the beginning of the last century, and they were images of black people created by white people who were pretty much mimicking
minstrelsy, blackface minstrelsy.
Minstrelizing. Yeah, exactly. To me, the artists who originally created that work weren't what I consider fine artists. They were more like caricature artists.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty much what you got. Rose Hill has taken this art and turned it into her own art. And she recreates it. I was at a show with her a number of years ago when she still lived here. She now lives in California, by the way, which is why she couldn't be here.
No.
But I was at a show with her, and there was a woman looking at it, and the woman was horrified. It was a white woman.
Right.
She was horrified, and she turned around, and she said, "How can they show this stuff here? Who is this artist?" And I smiled at her. I said, "This is Rose Hill. I'd like to introduce you. This is the artist." And
right.
The woman's jaw just dropped. She didn't know how to respond. but just to give you an idea of where she's coming from, there's...
And just to let people, just to paint the picture, no pun intended, for people, like there are a couple of pieces of hers that actually feature the old character, Little Black Sambo.
Little Black Sambo, yeah.
To make sure that you don't get it, it's there in the title.
Yeah.
Like Little Black Sambo and the Tiger.
She'll have a series she calls Little Colored Girls.
Right.
Little Black Sambo is a big one. She just loves Little Black Sambo. Now, Little Black Sambo originally was Indian.
Right.
I don't know if people are aware of that, but it was
I actually knew that.
Okay. Well, he was Indian, and people in the south of India are much darker than people in the north of India. And somehow that evolved into a reinterpretation back over 100 years ago, into what we all ended up looking at were these caricatures of black people, which were solid black. There was no fine tuning of anything. It was just solid black things with big white eyes staring at you.
Right.
And Rose Hill, she managed to capture that. There's a woman who was a professor of English at UVA, Lisa Woolfork. Can I read her quote?
Actually, we've got about 3 minutes, so if you want to talk to, because I know you want to.
Okay.
Daniel want to.
Yeah, right. Let's do that. Rose Hill, one of the really fine things she did while she was here, she started a program at the prisons where she was teaching art to prisoners in the local jail. It quickly spread to other prisons in the area. When she left, there's someone else who took that over, and he's with us here today. That's Daniel O'Neill. So let's use that as a transition and jump over to Daniel. Go ahead.
Hey, Daniel, how's it going?
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Tell us really briefly about this program of teaching arts in prison.
Well, it's been going for about 10 years now. It's been quietly ticking over. It's probably one of the most popular programs in Albemarle Jail. There's always a full schedule. We have two classes, a male and a female class. There's about 10 or 15 people that start every class. It gets winnowed down as people are released and so on. But it's always well subscribed. It's very popular. We probably have more people for that than anything else. The jail is blessed with a very good education program generally, but I find that the art program seems to be more popular than most possible. You do get people coming along to start with saying they're just using it possibly to escape the noise for a couple of hours, mm-hmm. and finding that they're suckered into the art. And at the end of it, they're the most enthusiastic people. They're the ones saying, hurry up and open the store cupboard. We've only got 2 hours. We've got to get going here. and you'll get people coming up to you at the end of, they're saying, I'm released. I'm being released next week. This is my last class. Could you give me a list of brushes and paints and books I could use outside? That's the most satisfying part of it. And that's when you know that the program is actually working and that it's reaching people. When somebody that actually joined the program because they just wanted to escape for a couple of hours at peace and quiet and is actually now actively becoming an artist when they leave.
Wow.
That means everything, and that makes the whole thing worthwhile as far as I'm concerned.
And they're pieces of inmate art sitting up in the exhibit.
Absolutely.
At McGuffey
now. We've got a few up there now, and we're going to have, thanks to Bob, we're going to have our own exhibit in October.
Oh, awesome.
And there's some wonderful. I've been storing art for quite some time now, the best stuff from the inmates. We have some wonderful pieces of art, and I'm really looking forward to being able to show them to people because they're striking people that you get preconceptions about prison art like you would anything else. I guarantee people are going to be surprised at what they see.
Well, I was surprised at just the six pieces that were there.
Yeah. Well, there's way better than that. We didn't give you the best, Bob, sorry. We kept the best for our own.
So, Bob, thank you so thank you so much, and thanks so much for McGuffey for doing this. This was such a great thing. Who do we have to thank for this exhibit?
As you know, every Saturday we had at least two different shows going on, live shows. So we had dance, music, storytelling, and this was all made possible by gifts from people and organizations in the area. I'm going to read them off quickly. Beatrix Ost, Ludwig Kuttner, the Ix Art Park, Price Automotive, Reynolds Subaru of Orange, Dave and Yana Geis, Tara Boyd, Southern Development Homes, Piedmont Realty Holdings of Crozet, Roger Voisinet, Dave and Elizabeth Waters, Grimm and Parker Architects, and TNN Printing, plus several people who wanted to remain anonymous.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very, very expensive venue that we put on, and it was all covered by these really generous individuals and organizations in our community, and we thank them.
Awesome, awesome. Thank you so much. You got till 5 to see them. That's it. We're out of time today. Remember, when you support art, you support the community. If you want to support the community, support art. This is Homegrown. Like to thank our guests today, Greg Morgoglione, Bob Anderson, Michael E. Williams, Daniel O'Neill. There we go. Our opening music today was from Spit It Out, Inc. Of course, our event music is by Positive Collective. We're doing a return to it right now. Any complaints about Homegrown should be directed to our attorneys at the fine lisping law firm of Tochterman, Overman, Munthen, and Burke, legal services that wrap around you like a thong. Remember to keep your dial on 94.7 WPBC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We'll be back with more art next week. Bye.
WPVC LP Charlottesville. You can contact the show on Facebook by searching Homegrown Charlottesville. Be sure to tune in again next Sunday at 10 for Homegrown, only on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.